From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember a wonderful poet, Jane Kenyon. She died 1 year ago of leukemia at the age of 47. In the last days of her life, she and her husband, poet Donald Hall, completed editing a book of her new and selected poems. That book has just been published. We've invited Donald Hall to read some of Kenyon's last poems, to read some of his poems about her, and to talk about their life together. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of a 1962 performance of the opera Susanna featuring the legendary American soprano Phyllis Curtin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The wonderful poet Jane Kenyon died a year ago Monday at the age of 47 of leukemia. Today we're going to remember her by talking about her life and death with her husband, poet Donald Hall. He's going to read some of her last poems and some of his own poems about her. They were married over 20 years. They lived in a farmhouse in New Hampshire. They had each served as the state's poet laureate. Sickness had become a familiar presence in their family. It was not long after Hall had gone into remission from his cancer that Kenyon was diagnosed with leukemia. After a bone marrow transplant, they were hopeful that she would survive. Then she got the news the leukemia had returned. In the next 11 days before she died, she and Hall finished editing a book of her new and selected poems. That book, Otherwise, has just been published by Grey Wolf Press. I asked Donald Hall to read the final poem in the book, which is the final poem Jane Kenyon wrote. It's called The Sick Wife.
It's an extraordinary poem to end the book with, and it's quite a story. At the very end, but before we knew she was going to die, her fingers didn't work. She couldn't write, really. She had there was an anti-rejection drug called cyclosporin, which disabled her fingers. On March 8th, 6 weeks before she died, but when we were still hopeful, I left her for about 6 hours. I hated to, but I wanted to do something with my son, and she was doing all right. And the neighbor came in, of course, and stayed with her. When I came back in the middle of the night, here was this poem written out in the neighbor's handwriting. And Jane had dictated a poem. It was about her coming, sitting in the car while I went in shopping, just, I think, the day before I went away. The next day, I typed it up, had it typed up, and then she would look at it from time to time and tell me, change X to Y. So she revised it a little bit. Then when she was dying, we knew this was not a finished poem. She would have made it better. I know, she knew too, but she couldn't face it then. And we chose the 20 finished poems to begin the book with. And then I said, and I'm so glad I thought of it, if I can find a way to print The Sick Wife and call it an unfinished poem, would that be all right? You know, she was very particular about how she represented herself. And she thought about it a minute, and she said, yes, if you can call it an unfinished poem, you can print it. Well, it's a pretty good unfinished poem, and it's the last poem in her book, The Sick Wife. The sick wife stayed in the car while he bought a few groceries. Not yet 50, she had learned what it's like not to be able to button a button. It was the middle of the day, and so only mothers with small children, or retired couples, stepped through the muddy parking lot. Dry cleaning swung and gleamed on hangers in the cars of the prosperous. How easily they moved, with such freedom, even the old and relatively infirm. The windows began to steam up. The cars on either side of her pulled away so briskly that it made her sick at heart.
I really like that poem, and I particularly like the image of the dry cleaning as it swung and gleamed on hangers on the cars of the prosperous.
You know, as I said it just then, I remember that one of the words she changed was gleamed. I don't remember what it was before, but I remember her saying, dry gleamed in there, sometime in March or very maybe early April.
I like the idea of something so kind of everyday and so trivial representing normal life, normal life going on, just the assumption that normal life is going to continue in people's lives. You were saying
she was so full of that in her poems. Normal life, the everyday things, tragedy going on around you, but the bird still spirals down the tree, and the dog still sniffs at the fence post. Always that.
This poem is written in the third person. She's not saying I, she's saying she. Did she often write about herself in the third person like that?
No, I don't think she did very often, and I think here the word I seemed possibly to ask for pity, and that putting it in the third person was putting it away a little bit. I don't think Jane said that, but that's my notion.
Did she try to write a lot when she was sick?
No. She just couldn't. She was, imagine being nauseated for 15 months. There were a couple of patches. When Jane was sick for 2 months, my mother died. And for a few days, Jane helped me to empty my mother's room at the old folks' home. And then Jane got very sick and almost died. That's another long story. But she wrote a poem called Eating the Cookies while she was sick, but in a better patch right then. And then in the 2 weeks in May or June, she was able to spend about 20 minutes a day revising her old work. Thank goodness. So many of these 21st early poems, you know, 20 new poems in this book, are among her best work, and she made little crucial changes. But those are the only times she could work. I worked beside her. I was, you know, I nursed her in an apartment after her bone marrow transplant, and I nursed her at home, and I sat beside her in the in various hospitals, probably 6 months out of the 15 months. And I wrote all the time, and I would read aloud to her when she felt like it. I read other things. We'd always read aloud to each other, but when she felt like it, I would read some poem I was working on, sometimes about her own illness, and she would help me with it. She loved doing that because at least one of us was working. But she could not work. She was in too much pain. The pain was not from the leukemia. The nausea was not from the leukemia. It was from the treatment that might have kept her alive. That's the irony of it. But we did keep her alive, and we had hope up until April 11th.
Did she believe in her poems, or was she losing confidence as she lost her health?
She was pretty depressed at the end there, and I remember her looking at the new poems and kind of shaking her head. But she knew she didn't know for sure. I thought they were marvelous, and I still do, and so do many other people. People consistently think that she was in her last work at top form, doing some of her best work. And perhaps she knew that the depression she felt about her illness and indeed her dying was coloring her appreciation. Clearly, because she wanted so much to make this book, and to make it the best book she could make it, she must have had good hope for her work.
You said before that you and she worked on her obituary before she died. What did she once said about her?
The one thing that just tickles me is that she wanted to make sure I got that Guggenheim in there. She was really proud of her Guggenheim, and so I got it in there all right. And then the New York Times slightly shortened it, and then Guggenheim was the last sentence of a paragraph, so it got cut out. I felt terrible. If I'd put it at the front of the paragraph, it would have been in there. But at any rate, the obit was conventional for the most part, but in among the honors, I guess that must have been the one that she cared about the most.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Donald Hall, and his wife, Jane Kenyon, died just a year ago, and there's a new collection of her poems called Otherwise, and we've invited Donald Hall to read some of Jane Kenyon's poems and some of his own poems from a forthcoming book called The Old Life. There's another poem by Jane Kenyon that I'd like you to read, and this is called Notes from the Other Side. When did she write this?
Notes from the Other Side is the last poem printed in Constance, which was the last book to come out in her lifetime. It came out in 1993, and I remember well that she wrote the last two poems, Otherwise, which has become the title poem of her posthumous book, and one of her most popular poems. She wrote Otherwise and Notes from the Other Side right at the end, just in time to get them into Constance. And she wrote them relatively quickly. Often it took her 6 months, a year, longer to finish a poem. But these came, well, I would say they came in within a week or so. And this was written in a great elation and excitement, the notes from the other side. I divested myself of despair and fear when I came here. Now there is no more catching one's own eye in the mirror. There are no bad books, no plastic, no insurance premiums, and of course, no illness. Contrition does not exist, nor gnashing of teeth. No one howls as the first clod of earth hits the casket. The poor we no longer have with us. Our calm hearts strike only the hour, and God, as promised, proves to be mercy clothed in light.
Do you know if she was thinking about her own death when she wrote this?
I don't. She didn't tell me what she was thinking of. She was thinking of death frequently, but seldom of her own. At this time when she wrote this poem, I had been ill and my chances were supposed to be poor. But I think she had a vision, unconnected to a particular person, to me or to her or anyone, of paradise, of a most positive view of life after death. When she died, after 15 months of such suffering, I'm afraid she was not so joyous as she was in this poem. The only thing that she said apropos to me, and it was the afternoon, I think, that we knew that she was going to die, she said, "I don't fear punishment." And then we didn't speak further. I didn't bring up this poem. I had a horror of trying to be cheerful, and I think she did too, as if any falsity was absolutely to be avoided. We both wanted paradise and to meet again in paradise so much that we couldn't speak of it.
Had she maintained her faith in God?
Yes, yes. Yet there was not a great deal of comfort. You know, C.S. Lewis, in that book of his about mourning, which of course I've consulted like so many people, talks about the absence of God initially, when you initially need him so much. We had a wonderful minister who presided at Jane's funeral, a marvelous woman named Alice Ling, and she prayed. I've never known anyone to pray so eloquently, so without rehearsal, beautifully, like making poem after poem. When Alice Ling was with us and praying, we were simply exalted, and it felt as if the presence of grace was in the room. But often there were long hours of the night when there was no grace present, and there was suffering and despair. But Jane wanted to live. She was astonished at how much she wanted to live. When I speak of despair, I don't mean despair of survival, but despair simply at the immediate circumstances of suffering.
Well, Jane wrote so many poems about depression, and she suffered with depression, I think, all of her life. And I can imagine how the depression and illness would feed on each other.
She was surprised at how little depression she felt in the sense of the old endogenous depression. She was surprised that she wanted to live so much. She went through one bad depression after the bone marrow transplant. And antidepressives cannot be given to people with suppressed immune systems, so there was no help for her. But for the most part, it was not that she was joyous, heaven knows. She was in pain, and she didn't like it. But she was determined and energetic in her determination, and she tried so hard. She took physical therapy when she could hardly move and tried to eat when nausea and mouth pain made it terribly difficult, excruciating, really, to try to eat. She was energetic in the wish to survive, despite the history of depression.
She really eloquently described her depressions, and I think a lot of people have found their own depressions in her poems. I would like you to read one of her poems about depression. It's a wonderful poem called Now Where.
Yes, that is. Yes. Now Where. It wakes when I wake, walks when I walk, turns back when I turn back, beating me to the door. It spoils my food and steals my sleep and mocks me, saying, "Where is your God now?" And so, like a widow, I lie down after supper. If I lie down or sit up, it's all the same. The days and nights bear me along. To strangers I must seem alive. Spring comes, summer, cool, clear weather, heat, rain.
It's a wonderful poem.
Isn't it? She talked about writing about depression for people who were not depressed to help them to understand it. I think what she did was to hold out a hand to other people who were depressed, to say, here I am, companion. And there is some redemption in the sharing of something terrible. I go to poems of elegy and loss now in my grief and in my mourning. I go to her own poems of grief and loss for consolation over Jane's death.
My guest is poet Donald Hall. We're remembering his late wife, Jane Kenyon. She died 1 year ago of leukemia. Her last poems are included in a new book of her work called Otherwise. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Donald Hall, we're remembering his late wife, Jane Kenyon. Was there anything you could do for each other's depressions? I know you've had depressions yourself.
I did not have it so severely as Jane did. And there were times when she was so low she was unreachable.
Mm-hmm.
It was terribly frustrating. I couldn't touch her. But there were things that we could do. When she was feeling awful and depressed, but not at the very pits, there were distractions. There was sometimes poetry. There was reading aloud. There was certainly touching. Loving was a respite when she was able to love.
You have a poem I'd like you to read. You were saying Jane's poems about depressions were written in part to describe to people who weren't depressed what it was like. And you have a poem about trying to deal with Jane's depressions and what that was like. Could you read that for us?
Yes. This is part of the old life. And Jane got severely depressed first in 1982, I think it was. She had been depressed before, but it became diagnosable at that point. And for several years, I could feel helpful sometimes. And then I had a terrible vision of some gain for myself out of this. This is a little poem. Curled on the sofa in the fetal position, Jane wept day and night, night and day. I could not touch her. I could do nothing. Melancholia fell like the rain over Ireland for weeks without end. I never belittled her sorrows or joshed at her dreads and miseries. How admirable I found myself.
That last line's a real stunner.
Yeah. I know. I hated to write it, but it was the only honest thing to write. I mean, I think I was kind to her and did well to her, but there was a point at which I realized, yes, I think I'm a big solid rock. I'm quite an old fellow, aren't I? I'm the steady one. And then, of course, that depressed me when I realized I had some secondary gain.
And the poem that you just read, I want to say, is from your forthcoming book, The Old Life. And I want you to read a little bit more from that book a little later. I think it's hard when someone you love is depressed to not take it personally, it's not your fault in some way.
Yeah. That was something that Jane worried about all the time, that I would think she was mad at me,
mm-hmm.
or that I think I somehow had caused it. And perhaps I did at the very beginning. We were married 23 years. And the depression got serious in maybe 9 years after we got married. I may have thought so earlier. I don't actually remember it. But I do remember her worrying about it. That's one of the things that occurred to her, one of when she was depressed. Twice she got doctors of her to make a little speech to me saying that this had nothing to do with me and I was not to feel bad, and if she was not there for me, it wasn't that she didn't love me. I really knew it, and I, you know, what each of the doctors was telling me, I really knew. I did not take it personally. I knew that it was not my fault. And I knew that if I acted as if I thought it was her fault, I'd just make things worse. So I just tried to be as kind as she was. She was the kindest person I've ever known, and most sensitive, and I tried to imitate her.
You know, the poems that you've read so far by Jane Kenyon, your late wife, were poems about death and depression. I want you to read one of her poems about ordinary life. She has wonderful poems about just ordinary, almost like haiku, just about the details of ordinary life. And there's a poem called Wash that I quite like.
That's a lovely one, yeah. I'd probably say that about anything, you know. But I do rather admire her work, you might say. But yeah, Wash is a lovely poem. Here's Wash. All day the blanket snapped and swelled on the line, roused by a hot spring wind. From there it witnessed the first sparrow, early flies lifting their sticky feet, and a green haze on the south sloping hills. Clouds rode over the mountain. At dusk, I took the blanket in, and we slept, restless, under its fragrant weight.
You know, I know that smell of a blanket.
I think that's kind of an erotic poem.
Uh-huh.
You do.
Yeah.
Certainly a poem in which the bodily life, the life of smelling and seeing and so on is clear. Maybe all that seems erotic to me.
When did she write that?
I can't remember exactly. Mm-hmm. I think probably mid-80s, a decade before she died.
Poet Donald Hall. His wife, Jane Kenyon, died 1 year ago. Her poems are collected in the new book, Otherwise. Donald Hall has a new book which includes poems about Kenyon. It's called The Old Life and will be published in early summer. Hall will be back with us in the second half of our show. Several tributes to Kenyon are planned. This evening in Concord, New Hampshire, poets will gather at the City Auditorium to read her work. Tributes are planned for April 30th in Manhattan, May 3rd at Harvard, and May 17th at Old Town Hall in Andover, Massachusetts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with poet Donald Hall about his late wife, poet Jane Kenyon. She died 1 year ago. He'll read the first poem he wrote after her death. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of a 1962 recording of the opera Susanna. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with poet Donald Hall. We're remembering his late wife, poet Jane Kenyon. She died of leukemia 1 year ago last Monday. The book she completed in the last days of her life has just been published. It's called Otherwise, New and Selected Poems. Some of Donald Hall's new poems about his wife are included in his new book, The Old Life, which will be published in the early summer. You and Jane had been sick a lot over the past few years. Jane had had salivary cancer about 10 or 11 years ago.
Right.
And after she was cured of that, you had colon cancer and that metastasized to liver cancer, and you came very close to death yourself.
And when, my chances were not good,
yeah.
According to my doctors and surgeon.
We talked, you, Jane Kenyon, and myself, on Fresh Air a couple of years ago. It was in September of 1993, and at the time you were in remission from liver cancer. And things were looking pretty good. And, we were talking a lot about how what it was like for Jane to take care of you. Had you always assumed that you would that she would outlive you?
Oh, yeah. We totally assumed it. I was 19 years older than Jane. And according to actuarial tables, she was my widow for 25 years. So we planned on it a lot. Why, we talked, when we were courting, we thought we shouldn't get married because she'd be a widow so long. So much for that. And then, I had, her salivary cancer was, of course, terribly scary, but it was totally encapsulated, and in retrospect, it was not much of a threat, really. Though, of course, we worried then about her death, but then we put it off. And I had statistically poor chances, and we assumed that I would die and she would outlive me a long time. We made lots of plans that way. Then extraordinarily and horrifyingly, it happened the other way. But I did take care of her as she took care of me. Maybe she was my model in that, as in so many things. In the program that we did with you 3 years ago, you had me read something where I said it seemed egotistical of me to think that my death would be the worst thing that could happen to Jane. And then I realized, well, my death would be the worst thing that could happen to Jane. And she agreed. But then, of course, her death has been the worst thing that could happen to me. But I'm saying this because I want to say something else that may sound a little odd. Taking care of her for 15 months was one of the best things in my life. I loved taking care of her, and she loved being taken care of. There are strange compensations. There's no compensation for Jane's death at the age of 47, but taking care of her was wonderful, and wonderful for both of us. As a depressive, I'm not sure she could ever really believe I loved her as much as I told her I did, and I think she knew. I think she knew. She said she knew. After all that taking care.
Did you show each other your work through your illnesses? Were there things you wanted to protect each other from because you were writing out of fear?
No, we didn't do that. We never did that. That's a perfectly sensible notion, but we didn't do it. We wouldn't do it. I read aloud to her poems that I was writing about her illness. I didn't. I would wait until they were in good shape. We never showed each other things immediately. We always worked on them before we showed them to her. But I would say, I've got a poem here about your leukemia, which I'd like to read to you. And she would give me literary criticism on it, perhaps, or just agree with it. When she was dying, I read one poem to her. We were working together on her obituary, working on words together, and she said how much fun that had always been. So I said, I want to read you one more poem, and brought her a poem. And she said, she concentrated, and she said, there's something missing. There's something you've left out. That's the kind of thing that we could tell each other. She didn't know what it was I'd left out. She could just tell there was something not there. But, she was not working when she was ill. When she did that revising in May, June 94, she indeed showed me those wonderful new poems that she was working on, like Happiness and Dutch Interiors and so on, beautiful things. But for the most part, she didn't have anything to show me. But I would actually sitting by her side in the hospital. I'd be writing, working on things. And then I would dictate them up so that my typist could make them clean, as opposed to my terrible handwriting. And she would overhear me sometimes. Sometimes she was too sick to pay attention or really to hear. but sometimes she would overhear it and say something. And other times I would say, can I read you a poem now? When I thought she was, you know, feeling better. And I would do it. So there were poems that she heard over and over again as I kept revising them. And she really loved it. And it was working together again. It was a happy thing.
I want you to read another poem, and this is called Weeds and Peonies. And this, I believe, yes. is a recent poem. Tell us about when you wrote this.
This was the first poem that I tried to write, that I began writing, after Jane died. And she was a great gardener. You can tell from her work. She writes about her flowers all the time. And her peonies were marvelous. We used to be worried that we'd cause traffic accidents because people driving by would swerve and pause to look at her peonies. You know, I'll tell you they were as big as basketballs, and I'm lying, but they were pretty big. They began to come up kind of diminished, and I walked around missing her terribly. And this is, you know, in the first two or three weeks last year after she died. I think the poem is pretty close to finished by this time, but close enough to read, certainly. Your peonies burst out, white as snow squalls, with red flecks at their shaggy centers, in your border of prodigies by the porch. I carry one magnanimous blossom inside to float in a glass bowl, as you used to do. Ordinary happiness, remembered in sorrow, blows like snow into the abandoned garden, overcoming the daisies. Your blue coat vanishes down Pond Road into imagined snowflakes, with Gus at your side, his great tail swinging. But you will not return, tired and satisfied, and grief's repeated particles suffuse the air, like the dog yipping through the entire night, or the cat stretching awake, then curling, as if to dream of her mother's milky nipples. A raccoon dislodges a geranium from its pot. Flowers, roots, and dirt lie upended in the back garden, where lilies begin their daily excursions above stone walls in the season of old roses. I pace beside weeds and snowy peonies, staring at Mount Kearsarge, where you climbed wearing purple hiking boots. Hurry back. Be careful climbing down. Your peonies lean their vast heads westward as if they might topple. Some topple.
It's a wonderful poem.
Thank you.
Have you been keeping up the garden?
No. I've taken on some of her characteristics, but not the garden. It happens, apparently, when the spouse dies, that the survivor begins to resemble the dead one. And I've done it in several ways, good ones and bad ones. I mean, pleasant ones and unpleasant ones. But I don't think the garden is taking. I think I'll hire somebody to do it. It's depressing for me to imitate her. I feel so inadequate compared to her in the garden. In many ways, but certainly in the garden. I don't mean that's a good reason. I just don't seem to be doing it.
What are some of her traits that you feel you've picked up?
Well, last autumn I really noticed it for the first time. She always fed the birds and loved the birds and knew a lot about them. And she wasn't primarily a birder. She was more fond of flowers, more fond of music. But the birds were big to her all the same, and I always took them for granted. Our birds are perfectly fine, you know. But this fall, I found myself for the first time in my life standing as still as I could near the bird feeder to watch them, and then coming out with books and identifying them. And after about 2 weeks of this, I thought, what am I doing? Oh, I know what I'm doing. I'm taking it over from Jane. And that was lovely, and I love the birds. I bought a lot of suet. I went in for it in a big way. But then also my whole life, I guess. I've always liked it when it got dark early in the autumn. It felt cozy to me. And Jane was more SAD, seasonal affective disorder. She got depressed when the light went out of the sky. And this year I found myself noting and feeling, oh, abandoned when the light started to go out of the sky. And I seem to be taking something on from Jane. even in writing poems, I've been consciously thinking as I'm working on poems. I've been writing every day for a year, and not about any other subject but Jane. I've been writing her a lot of letters, keeping her up with things. But when I'm in the middle of a poem or in the middle of a revision sometimes, I catch myself thinking, what would Jane have done here? And I couldn't really be like her if I tried, you know. But I'm sort of consulting her, as it were, even when I'm writing.
It was interesting because you were her college teacher. That's how you met.
Yes, but that's a long time ago. Right. Yeah. She was my teacher as much as I was hers in the long run. We started out that way, sure. I was the old guy. I was 19 years older than she was. But she led me. I would try to argue she led me more than I led her. But maybe it was a tie. When we talked about it, we just argued back and forth without rancor, taking opposite positions. She taught me a great deal, I'm sure of that, about poetry and about, I don't know, kindness, charity.
My guest is poet Donald Hall. We're remembering his late wife, Jane Kenyon. She died 1 year ago of leukemia. Her last poems are included in a new book of her work called Otherwise. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Donald Hall, we're remembering his late wife, poet Jane Kenyon. How is your health now?
My health seems fine. I continue to have the quarterly test for recurrence of cancer, and nothing has showed up. And otherwise, my other little complaints of a senior citizen all seem under control. I feel fine. Physically.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Are you living alone in your house now?
Yes, I'm living alone, and it's important for me to live in that house alone. I go away and do poetry readings. I don't want to be away very long. I go off and read her poems, and right now there are a whole series of tributes to her work coming up, 4 of them in about 3 weeks. And I'm traveling to those, and I'll read her work and hear other people read her work. I'm working partly traveling for Jane Kenyon Industries, as it were. Every bit of attention to Jane's work pleases me and helps me. But I'm also, of course, doing my own work and reading my own poems. Mostly, I want to be alone. I feel closest to her when I am alone in that house and with the cat and the dog that she was with. I do see other people. I'm not totally reclusive, but then I have a son and a daughter and some grandchildren who are totally dear to me. Being alone in the house is closest to Jane.
I'd like you to read the final poem from your book, The Old Life. And it's called Without.
This is a poem. I'm going to read only part of it. But any part of it, it's an unusual kind of poem, because sort of any part of it will do for the whole. This is a poem which is about what it was like to have leukemia for 15 months. Really, for Jane and for me, since, when I had my cancer, it was our cancer. When she had leukemia, it was our leukemia. And this was a poem that I read aloud to Jane many times as I was working on it. And her comment was invariably, "You've got it, Perkins. That's it. That's it." It's a poem called Without, and it's without punctuation and virtually without full sentence structure. The experience of this long illness, so repetitious, so painful, was that of a lack of divisions. One day was like another. Here are first 4 stanzas of this poem. We live in a small island stone nation, without color under gray clouds and wind, distant the unlimited ocean, acute lymphoblastic leukemia without seagulls, or palm trees without vegetation or animal life, only barnacles and lead-colored moss that darkens when months do. hours, days, weeks, months, weeks, days, hours. The year endures without punctuation. February without ice, winter, sleet, snow, melts and recovers, but nothing without thaw, although cold streams hurtle. No snowdrop or crocus rises, no yellow, no bright leaves of maple without autumn. No spring, no summer, no autumn, no winter, no rain, no peony, thunder, no wood thrush. The book is 1,000 pages without commas, without mice, maple leaves, windstorms, no castles, no plazas, no flags, no parrots, without carnival or the procession of relics, intolerable without brackets or colons, silence without color, sound without smell, without apples, without pork to rupture, gnash, unpunctuated without churches, uninterrupted, no orioles, ginger, noses, no opera, no, without fingers, daffodils, cheekbones. The body is a nation, a tribe dug into stone, assaulted white blood broken to fragments.
Donald Hall, have you ever written a poem like that before, just formally?
No. I haven't. I remember that I began this poem in Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital in New Hampshire at her third or fourth hospitalization. And I thought that this year there is no spring and no summer, no autumn, no winter. We could look out the window and see it, but it wasn't there. And then I thought it's without punctuation, and I began to write. And I began to write without punctuation because that is what our life was like.
You know, as a poet, what you do when you write is you stand back from experience and put it into words, describe it. Can I ask you to describe for us the impulse to always do that?
It's strange, isn't it? It's such an impulse at the heart of my life. I wrote my first poem when I was 12, but then I got serious when I was 14. And, you know, I've mostly written every day since I was 14. So that it's so much a part, it's as much a part of my life as breakfast as eating. It's just invariable. And it's hard for me to understand how you can cope with the disasters and grievings of life without the ability to try to write about it. It's as if I'd been writing for 50-odd years in order to write now about Jane's suffering and death. Poetry, other people's poetry, helps me. I would hope that mine would help other people. But writing now, the poems I'm not reading to you today because I'm still writing them, helps me by attempting to get my grief whole on the page and my love and my loss and get it into the shape of art. I could write a journal if I were just recording my feelings. That's not what I'm doing. I'm trying to embody my feelings in the work of art that can be apprehended or taken in by another human being. And that's what I've been trying to do since I was 14. But sometimes it seems as if I didn't have anything so important to do until now.
I want to thank you so much for reading your poems and some of Jane's poems for us. I really appreciate your being with us. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
Poet Donald Hall. His wife, Jane Kenyon, died 1 year ago of leukemia. Her poems are collected in the new book, Otherwise, New and Selected Poems. Donald Hall has a new book, which includes several poems about Kenyon. It's called The Old Life and will be published in early summer. Tonight, Donald Hall and several other poets will pay tribute to Kenyon at a reading in Concord, New Hampshire's City Auditorium. Several of her poems have been set to music by Pulitzer Prize-winning composer William Balcom. His new song cycle will premiere in September at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor in a performance by Benita Valente. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says he's in a dilemma. He's usually stuck listening to great works in performances that are inadequate, but today he's reviewing what he thinks is a magnificent performance of a work he doesn't especially admire, Carlisle Floyd's 1955 opera, Susanna.
This is a recording of such historical importance that it should be required listening for anyone interested in opera. Any recording that features the legendary American soprano Phyllis Curtin is automatically significant. Besides her distinctive voice, her musicianship, and her extraordinary dramatic conviction, she's one of the rare American sopranos who identified herself as an American. She not only sang the standard European repertoire, she performed and inspired new American music. But she recorded relatively little. She became dean of Boston University's School for the Arts and retired from performing about a decade ago. Now she teaches and is artist in residence for the Boston Symphony Vocal Program. The best-known part written for her is the title role of Carlisle Floyd's opera, Susanna, and we now have a rare live performance of it from the height of her career. She's in thrillingly intense voice, a voice of searing passion and exquisite delicacy. The plot is an Americanized version of the story from the Apocrypha of Susanna and the elders who think she's immoral because they see her swimming naked. In the opera, she's a mountain girl from Tennessee whose native high spirits are willfully misread as promiscuity. A corrupt preacher seduces her, so there are also elements of The Scarlet Letter and Somerset Maugham's Sadie Thompson story, Rain. Susanna sings two of the few contemporary arias that have actually entered the standard recital repertoire, Ain't It a Pretty Night, and the folk song, The Trees on the Mountains. Phyllis Curtin's sincerity makes even bits of dialogue hair-raising. Here's the end of the scene in which the hypocritical preacher, Olin Blitch, played with sympathetic complexity by Norman Traigle, tries to defend Susanna's innocence without admitting his own complicity in her losing it.
I tried, Susanna, yes. Up to you, I swear I will.
Ah. please try to forgive me.
The live performance of Susanna on this disc was presented in 1962 by the New Orleans Opera, 7 years after the world premiere in Tallahassee. Besides Phyllis Curtin, the strong cast includes the also too little recorded Norman Traigle, who sang the first New York performance a year after the opening and for many years thereafter. Tenor Richard Cassily is outstanding as Susanna's brother, who ends up shooting the preacher. Newt Anderson conducts with incisive dramatic strokes. Carlisle Floyd himself staged this production, which surely accounts for part of its energy. I wish the opera were a little less manipulative and melodramatic, a little less derivative of Puccini by way of Menotti. The satire on prudery and family values is timely, but awfully heavy-handed. If only Susanna had a touch of Virgil Thomson's slyness to temper its overwrought overstatement. At least Phyllis Curtin and her colleagues give it the ring of truth.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new 2-CD set of a live performance of Carlisle Floyd's opera Susanna from a 1962 production starring the legendary American soprano Phyllis Curtin. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Roberta Shurrock, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.